Welcome to Level with Emily Reese. This is music by Guy Whitmore for Bejeweled Stars. You'll hear all about the adaptive music he wrote for that in just a bit, including the Cat Choir, of course. First, you'll hear from Patron of the Week, Mike Maynor. Mike lives here in the Twin Cities, and I've had the pleasure of meeting him a few times at conventions and stuff around town. A lot of the tracks on his list came from the early gaming days, and so we chatted about which consoles he had as a kid. And then we talk about Life in the Mines from Donkey Kong Country by David Wise and Terra's Theme from Final Fantasy VI by Nobuo Uematsu.
Well, I had an Atari 2600, but the one I really remember the most was the Nintendo. I got that when I was about 8, and been playing, well, played quite a bit, you know, had the Nintendo, Super Nintendo and such, and then unfortunately when I got to college, then I kind of ended up taking a bit of a break on gaming, just because of being busy, and then started a family after that, but then got back into it again with listening to your show, and I was amazed how much the music had changed.
And you've always loved the music in games, right?
Yeah. The Donkey Kong game that you mentioned, that one was the first soundtrack I got. It was probably early high school, and I remember having to. I saw that you could actually get the soundtrack on a CD, and I thought that was just the coolest thing ever. So I snail mailed it in, and you know, a while later got a soundtrack back in the mail and listened to that, and just fell in love with that one immediately.
What did you like about that particular track that you chose from the soundtrack?
It just really kind of hit me as just a beautiful piece to listen to. I really liked how it fit in with the game, too. It sounded like you're kind of in a cave or in a mine.
Yeah.
Kind of all alone, and it would kind of echo back and forth with the call and response. And then it kind of gave that eerie quality because you're all alone trying to work your way through the mine. David Wise did an amazing job on that one.
So talk to me about Terra's Theme.
Terra's Theme, it's one of those big earworms from playing through Final Fantasy VI. Just, you never get it out of your head because you listen to it so much. But it's such a beautiful piece again. And it's great instrumentation for the Super Nintendo. Great full sound and everything. And I really like the samples that they had. Really love the sound of the flute and everything, and so that's really the part that I like the best on it, I guess. I found both of these pieces and both of these soundtracks really great for study music, because I would just listen to these on repeat basically while, during high school and college, and just kind of helped get through things, and it was a lot of fun.
Mike's list also included Vampire Killer from Castlevania by Michiro Yamane, overworld theme from The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past by Koji Kondo. Dragonborn from Skyrim by Jeremy Soule. And Baba Yetu from Civilization IV by Christopher Tin. This version comes from Christopher's Calling All Dawns album. You can become a patron of the week and be on the show to talk about your favorite video game music. We'd love to talk with you. Learn how to be one at patreon.com/level. Composer Guy Whitmore moved to Seattle in the mid-90s to work for Sierra Games, and he's been in the area pioneering console and mobile game music ever since. He's been composing for PopCap for several years now, and I love the music he made for the new Match 3 game Bejeweled Stars. Guy was one of the early leaders in adaptive music, that's music that changes when certain things happen in games.
I actually brought a lot of console ideas to mobile to begin with, and I think some of the aesthetics are certainly different, but the techniques are largely shared, or can be, I should say. They aren't always crossed over, but we use the same tools that we would use on a console game. In fact, we've done, like Peggle 2 was for Xbox One and PlayStation 4, for example. So we've gotten to work in all those areas. But to come back to Bejeweled Stars, I've always had an interest in having music and my scores be a much more integral part of what's going on in terms of the game design, its motion, what the player's doing, and the art. Because when you watch film or television, the synchronization is explicit. Even when it's subtle on purpose. And in games, it's fairly loose by and large. So it's been one of my mantras to kind of try out different things and see what works, because we're kind of in an experimental period where there isn't a way of doing this yet that is set in stone. Thank goodness, because I love the pioneering part of this. So starting off, I treat each game completely different, and I start it by simply playing the game a ton and working with the game directors and game designers and having conversations with them, much like a film composer would talk to the film director before filming starts, for example, mm-hmm. and just kind of living with the game and understanding the flow of what's going to happen and what the important moments are, and from a design perspective, how we want to pull the player along, because music can aid in that, and it can aid in the design intentions as well. It can emphasize sure. things, it can de-emphasize things, it can set the pacing, it can increase or decrease the pacing, and all of those things are possible now. So I tend to not think technically. So one of my rules and tenets when I start a score is the creative leads the technical always, right? Mm-hmm. And at every stage, I kind of try to back out and say, okay, technical stuff aside, how is it functioning aesthetically? So after looking and playing at it for a while, I will write some themes that might work kind of with the general mood and pacing. But pretty soon I will do one of the techniques I do is I capture a lot of footage from the game as it is, whatever early stage, as a video, and then bring that into my linear DAW and begin writing music to it as if it were a short trailer or a short episode of some kind, without worrying about how I'm going to achieve this type of scoring technically later, but just kind of creatively, what are my thoughts? What do I want to have happen? What are my instincts telling me about what visuals to hit and what points to emphasize? That's how the mock-ups typically happen. And then I back out and go, oh no, now how am I going to do this interactively? Because I'll often have all this detail, you know? So I kind of reverse engineer my own scoring. And because I think going into a score with a technical design in mind is the cart before the horse.
Okay.
I want to have my creative goals together. So for this one, what I saw happen, the length of a gameplay can be anywhere from literally a minute to several minutes. So I have to keep that in mind. You have this span of about a minute to several minutes. And I always like to have music develop intentionally across that. So the music will build up as the gameplay goes on, and it's based on a couple of factors. One is, how many moves do I have left? Well, I can tie that data from the game as how many moves do I have left, basically starts ramping up percussion so that as there are fewer and fewer moves left, the percussion comes up in the mix. And when there's only three or four moves left, you get this special little chime tone that comes in. It's still part of the music, but it lets you know, it's like, hey, you only have a few moves left. So again, it's both aesthetic in that the music isn't static, but it also helps with the design because it's like, oh, there's that sound. Whether they know it consciously or not, they get to this point where it's like, yeah, I'm close to the end here. And then the other factor is how close I am to the goal. See, the other one is how close am I to losing, like running out of moves.
Right.
And the other one is how close am I to completing my goal. And there I literally slowly over time, the mix transitions from one where the more kind of synth arpeggio part is up in front of the mix and the cello is in back, to reversing that and adding some other elements as well, so that over time the more melodic elements start to rise to the surface as you complete the level. So that's the bed. That's the kind of foundation of gameplay. But then there's all the different kinds of matches. You get just a standard match 3, and you get cascades and flame gems and all those. And the inspiration, and I'm going to say this as humbly as I can, because it's only a point of inspiration. You know, as a young kid watching the Fantasia, you know, movie, seeing how music could be accented by visuals, this is almost the reverse. But I wanted those spectacular visual particle effects to have musical gestures with them. If I had written a static piece of music, those things would never line up. So I had to write little clips, we call them stingers, that overlay, that get triggered as any of those events happen. So the creating a flame gem is one, and it, you know, little brass lick that happens. And when you use the flame gem, there's a riff that happens that happens. So each gem has a special set of stingers, one for creating it and one for detonating it.
Okay.
And then those are lined up with the music, kind of in a, you can think of it like a quantizer where it waits for the next eighth note or the next quarter note to play. So it's still synchronized, but happens pretty quickly.
Sure.
But still synchronized with the music. And then all of those things add up to make the score. Then there's a little piano riff that happens every time. As you get cascades, you get the little da-loom, da-loom, da-loom piano parts that progress as you go too. And I know where those things are kind of going to happen. I know that the big gem matches are going to happen as they swipe. And I know that the little piano riffs and the harp cascades are things that happen after the fact.
Okay.
So as the board is kind of filling up again, you hear the little piano and harp riff. So I kind of know, you know, that it's going to be make a move, hear a stinger of some kind, and then the board refills with those harps and piano parts.
Space did you have?
That's a fun question. Because people love it, you know, because games use gigs of audio these days.
Right.
We had for all sound and music 10 megabytes of content.
That's 10
megabytes.
Crazy.
Yeah, that includes the cat choir and the whole bit.
So did you sample them then?
Yes.
Okay.
So part of the story is, for both size reasons, but also for the dynamic. People talk about the way I've been working with MIDI and sample banks as simply a way to save memory, and it certainly does that. You know, it allows me to reuse and recombine things in ways that recorded files simply wouldn't. But it also, because it's broken down to the note level with these MIDI files, it allows for a much more dynamic interplay between those files. And with real-time reverb going on, that also helps makes things smoother and glues things together as well. So that's a very important aspect of it as well. So
the reverb.
Yeah. We have real-time reverb on everything.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah.
How does that help? What is that? I mean, I understand how reverb works, but
right.
Tell me more about that.
Well, think of it this way. When you're creating a piece of music in a traditional DAW, whether it's Logic or Pro Tools or what have you, you are putting your elements together, you're using MIDI with sample libraries and or live recorded musicians. You lay all those things out, and then you're adding reverb or compression or delay effects and all those things that you apply to each instrument to make them the quality that you want overall happen usually in a linear DAW. And then you mix that down into a baked linear file. But since the MIDI is live in Wyze, and the sample banks are there as well, you can't really apply MIDI ahead of time. I'm sorry, reverb ahead of time. I mean, you can put a little bit on each sample, but that's not the same.
Okay.
So I basically, what I call Wyze is it's my new DAW. It's where I actually do a lot of the composing.
In Wyze?
Yeah, and the mixing
wow.
as well. Obviously, the interface isn't to a place where I can do all of my composing there. I start mm-hmm. in a linear DAW. I use Nuendo right now. And bring in the MIDI files and the sample banks, and then basically finish the arranging and the mixing all in Wyze. And I've often done a lot of like, oh, I could take these MIDI files and recombine them and, blah, 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 and create a whole new queue right in Wyze out of all the elements I already have there. So applying reverb is exactly the same as I would in a linear DAW. It's just that I need to do it in real time because all the music is being generated in real time. You know, in an ideal world, I'd also have real-time mastering as well. I've done that on certain games where you have like a, you know, a limiting compressor on the master output bus
okay.
as a way to what you would normally do with a film mix, you know, just to kind of give it that last touch.
Sure.
But in a dynamic game, and the same holds for Jacqueline's sound effects, and which are
brilliant,
totally brilliant, and. An integral part of the music, I'll come back to the effects part, but a lot of what Jacqueline does with the sound effects is actually synthesis. It's not even using assets. They're using,
wow.
you know, sine waves and triangle waves and then combining, doing real-time synthesis, and those need real-time reverb, in other words, to also help put the final touch on that. And her elements kind of bleed into the music. I mean, totally bleed into the music. Sometimes she'll do something that's tonal, and that inspires me to do something. So she's definitely part composer on this for sure. It's hard for me to hear the music without the sounds.
Awesome. So 10 megs then.
10 megs. 2.5 or 2.8 or something, I think I came under, of music sample banks. So like under about, let's call it 3 megabytes of music samples.
Okay.
Because we had voiceover for the cat and the crow and all that, and then Jacqueline's mm-hmm. sound effects that she had. So total of 10 megabytes. And what we did to get the music samples was also kind of interesting. Because it's not legal to simply take your favorite sound sample library and just and put them into a game raw, you just can't, not legally allowed to do that. We decided, well, I need orchestral instruments. What am I going to do? We went over to Studio X here in Seattle and recorded our own.
Nice.
Yeah, we spent a week or so over there recording the Northwest Symphonia. And
they're so fabulous.
Yes, they're really great. I mean, so we had a blast and they loved it too. So we did the standard, like, okay, we need held notes at various dynamics, and we did it section by section. So we had violins in, and we had violas in, and cellos, section by section, and basically created our own sample library.
So tell me about the cat choir, because,
yes.
I mean, who can't love that?
I know. It was funny when I discovered that Rossini has his cat duet. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And I heard it again in a recital recently. I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. So this is a good example of where working closely with the game director paid off, because we knew we wanted that kind of big, heroic fanfare at the end with kind of a pop cap, quirky flair that is typical in our games. And we wanted to do something original in this case. And in talking to the game director, Amy Carlson, she like, well, I picture a row of cats in the stars singing. And she was speaking figuratively, and I said, no, I think we can do that. 2 days later, I basically had the mix laid out.
So incredible.
The other funny part to that is when I was mocking it up, I was using one of those libraries where you can kind of type in your phonetic syllables, and I typed in meow. So I had this choir going meow, meow, and doing just kind of faking it with that choir. It sounded pretty good enough to sell it to the team. The team bought into it right away.
Nice.
So we dropped it into the game, and it almost got cut from the game because the testers and other people outside of the team, you know, because it wasn't a real choir, thought it was saying something like evil instead of meow. I had to calm everybody down and say, no, we're going to get a real choir to sing the real phrases, and we'll emphasize the meow with the aesthetic we want. And so, and the chorale came through for us in flying colors, and it was just absolutely wonderful to work with them on that. And they had fun, too. They looked at the score, and, you know, it's written out in, you know, soprano alto, and they see the only word is meow.
What could go wrong?
They're like, hmm.
I'd love to know how you got into composing, first of all. Were you always interested in music when you were a kid?
Yes, yes. As soon as I took my first guitar lesson, that was kind of it. I think I was 7 or 8. And I was like, whoa. I didn't think about making a living, but I just glommed onto it and just played and played, and then started in bands in middle school and picked up classical guitar in high school. After seeing Angel Romero play, I was just kind of blown away. It's like kid from Wisconsin, never exposed to much classical music, sees this guy just tearing it up. So I started in with classical guitar and studied classical guitar at Northwestern University and then at Southern Methodist University, and always was interested in composing along the way, took theory and composition courses along the way and written songs and so forth. But it wasn't until grad school and I was pretty much done with my guitar degree, and I loved the composition team there, headed up by Marty Swidell at SMU, and I said, I want to get a double master's adding composition to this. And that's kind of where things really changed for me in terms of what I was thinking about for career. They have a great electroacoustic music studio there, and the instruction was very open-minded. I could add both, you know, what I was learning about traditional classical music to my pop and rock music upbringings. So it was just a great ground for getting both the technical and creative chops that would help me later. I didn't know what I was learning would help me in games, but I was learning synthesis and sampling and, you know, how to work with those early DAWs in the 90s. And it set me up perfectly for what I was going to be doing professionally.
Were you gaming at that time? Were you always a gamer?
Not in college, oddly. And I should say not in grad school, for sure, because grad school kind of ate up my whole time. But yes, in fact, my early memories, you know, going over to a friend's house who had, you know, the early NES consoles, and and then literally a few blocks away from where I lived, one of these classic early 80s arcades opened up. So I found myself playing a lot of Centipede, and that was my jam there. And then lost touch with that as I went through into grad school, but it came roaring back after graduating. But it wasn't until a colleague of mine from SMU called me and said, hey, you know, there's an opening here at Sierra, and he was up in Seattle, and I think you should look at this. And I looked into it. I was like, wow, I haven't even thought about gaming for a career. So all of a sudden, 2 + 2 were added, and I was like, I could do that. So I really worked hard on this demo, and they flew me up, and then that's when I never looked back. I've been doing that ever since.
And you've been in Seattle ever since, correct?
Yeah, lucky.
And weren't you a founding member of a group of composers there, too?
Yeah, with Hummy Man. The Seattle Composers Alliance was a group still together. I'm still moderately active with them, and they do a lot of great stuff just bringing composers together here regionally. But it started off with, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 of us who were like, hey, we all do this, different aspects. Some of us were game composers, some were commercial composers, some were film or TV. And decided we liked hanging out, and then we made it official. So that's how the Seattle Composers Alliance came about.
I would love to know a little bit more about what you did when you were at Sierra, because from what I understand, you've been working on adaptive music for a long time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because I guess it's one of those things where I was a little naive at the time early in my career, and I just thought that making the music adaptive to fit the visuals and the design was what people did or should do. I didn't think of it as like, oh, I'm going to do this cool thing. It was more about thinking about what ought to be. So early on at Sierra, the very first game I did was Sierra's first CD-ROM game was Mixed Up Mother Goose Deluxe.
Little Jack Horner sat in a corner eating his Christmas pie.
Hawking Cole
obviously a kid's game, but I got to not only score this background music, but Mother Goose was mixed up, so you had to take Little Bo Peep and lead her to her sheep. And then when the sheep got together with Little Bo Peep, she would sing a song. So I would set each nursery rhyme to a different pop genre, like Little Bo Peep, I believe, was New Wave, for example. Old Mother Hubbard, I think, was blues, and we had a Humpty Dumpty rap, and we just kind of picked all these styles that were kind of happening at the time, and we actually got to ship a separate soundtrack CD in the box with the CD-ROM, and that one was nominated for Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences Award that year. So that was a great way to start, but it really wasn't until the next game, Shivers, I started thinking about nonlinearity and started doing things like, well, instead of creating a minute-long cue, I'm going to create about a dozen short little files that I'll have the programmer trigger randomly with some space in between them to create a non-looping ambience.
This dare was kind of your idea, you know. But I'm glad I'm me out here and not you in there.
Closer.
So my mind was already kind of thinking on that before tools existed. And then it wasn't until I left and went to a company called Monolith Productions. And there, a tool was put in my lap, which was eventually to become Direct Music. And Direct Music allowed me to do all kinds of cool things without having to lean so much on programmers. So starting with a game called Shogo, Mobile Armor Division, that was the first game where I was working with MIDI type files with sample banks and seamless transitions between different intensities. That game had like your battle and tension and ambient and silence. And it was like a grid where you could go from any one to any of those other moods and do it seamlessly, you know, as those things happened in the game. I was very fortunate that my manager kind of said, put the software in front of me and said, hey, figure this out and see what you can do. And he gave me a month to just play around with it. So that kind of really set things going. And from there, I always endeavored to kind of add those adaptive elements to my games. And that was still in like 97, 98. Interestingly, I thought at that moment there was a lot of buzz around interactive or adaptive music, and there was this kind of what felt like momentum that this would just kind of sweep the industry. But it didn't for a couple of reasons. One, it was the tools were still really, really not user-friendly at all. So many composers just looked at it and didn't want to deal with it. And that's partly why I think it didn't happen. Also at the time, surround and live orchestral recording really started to take off. And the technology wasn't quite there yet to make live orchestral recordings that adaptive. Although these days, it's totally possible. As I say, the excuses are gone. It's totally possible to take full orchestral recordings. If you record them in phrases and in stems, it's totally possible to make a completely adaptive score with live recordings.
It's a good time to be alive for game audio, that's for sure.
It really is, right? So much is happening and in every aspect of it. And yeah, my interest only grows every time I do a game.
Well, thanks so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thanks for listening to episode 30 of Level with Emily Rees. You can learn more about Guy Whitmore at patreon.com/level. If you like our show, you can become a patron for as little as $1 a month, so that's about 25 cents a show. Learn more at patreon.com/level. I'm Emily Rees. Sam Keenan is our producer. Say hi, Sam. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Level with Emily, and learn more about Sam and me at june-media.com. Remember, June is J-O-O-N.